One Bell of the Afternoon Watch. And this is your captain, Captain Joe, up in the captain's chair for our weekly time together on Voice of Vashon, 101.9 on the FM band, booming out all over the magical Isle of Vashon with probably about 5 watts and streaming live all over the world on voiceofvashon.org, where if I get it right, after the broadcast and get it put into archive correctly later on today, if you're not able to listen to me live, which I always hope you are, then you should be able to find me in the Voice of Vashon archive. My traditional greetings and weekly greetings to all of Captain Joe's people all over the world, from Singapore on one side of the world, all of the way to the Kingdom of Sweden, whose capital is Stockholm. On the other side of the world, all of the ships at sea, in particular the Coast Guard cutters that are deployed all over the world about their father's business, and all of the aircraft in the air, and all of the rescue stations that are busy plucking people from the water such that they may live once again. The reason why we did not have a broadcast from the captain's chair last week was that we were doing a what's called here in the States Give Big, and it was the opportunity in particular on the Magical Isle for all of the, or as many as we could get together, of the various do-goods on the island to come and talk about their programs and to candidly ask for money, because that's how they keep themselves going, is through, most of them rely on and depend on public donations in order to carry out their various missions. I took my time and a little bit more, and Kate and I worked together to host a number of island do-goods. And that leads me to thank all of Captain Joe's people who contributed to the Voice of Vashon, because it is those contributions that keep the captain's chair, from the captain's chair, alive and thriving. And I am enormously grateful, and so is the Voice of Vashon, because the people who belong to the sort of loosely organized group called Captain Joe's People are the most generous of people, and I am told by the management of Voice of Vashon that we provide probably as much as any other listening group, maybe even more. Certainly, this is a very active listening group in the sense that I hear from you when things don't get put up into the archive, or when you have things that you want to talk about that you want me to talk about. So it is that kind of a program. It is your program, and it is my program as well. So you are more than welcome to carefully, respectfully, but firmly send me signals when there are things that you either disagree with, or that you agree with, or that you would like me to talk about. The binnacle list has been amplified this week by a couple of new entries, and I am particularly concerned this week in two areas. The first area is those who are suffering some really severe orthopedic problems, having trouble to getting around. My friend, colleague, Captain Truman O'Brien is one of those. I relieve him here at the Gene Bosch studio. He does a broadcast just one program slot removed from mine, and he's having some really serious orthopedic problems, and so I have been leaning into him about getting that both properly examined and then properly treated. And this is the same request and hope and command from the captain's chair, that all of you who are in this situation, that you get the diagnostic tests that are necessary to really figure out what's going on, and then follow the instructions of your practitioner to fix that. It is no secret. I've made it no secret that in the last 2 years, both because of the virus and also because of personal situations, that there's been more than enough sadness in your captain's life, and it is not time for many of you to move on, to cross your bar. And so those are my wishes and my hopes that you will follow what you've got to do to take care of it. The second one is a more of an emotional one, and every now and then we find ourselves in a situation where we think something should happen to us, and something good should happen to us, and it doesn't. Something intervenes. And it has always been my strongly held conviction that when those things happen, that we take whatever time is necessary to kind of slop around in it, feel sorry for ourselves if necessary, but then we pick ourselves up and we move on. Because each one of us, each one of Captain Joe's people is responsible for some other person. And if there happens to be at any given time no other person for whom you are responsible, you're responsible for yourself. And so the energy that goes into whining, mewing, and puking about the unfairness and inequities of life needs to be minimized, get it done with, and then move on. If I had ever been passed over for promotion, or if I had ever been passed over for command, and in both cases I had to go before, or my record had to go before a selection board, and I never was passed over for promotion, and I never was passed over for command, but if those things had happened, I had made a firm resolve that I would not appeal that particular decision, that I would accept it as having been made by people who knew what they were doing and would then continue on doing the best that I could with whatever decisions I made after that. And so that's what I have to say about all of that. I've done a little bit of reading about lighthouses because last Sunday was Mother's Day, Mothering Sunday in England. They do separate it somewhere, celebrate it on a different day. But in the UK, it's called Mothering Sunday. And here, of course, it was Mother's Day. And I spent the day out at Point Robinson Lighthouse giving tours, and we were open for the first time publicly for the first time in almost 2 years. And it was just a glorious day. The sun was out. It was a beautiful, beautiful day. And there were literally people who came in, wanted to talk about not only about our lighthouse, my lighthouse, Point Robinson Light, quick flash 2 every 12 seconds, but also about lighthouses in general and about the effects that the virus has had on so many things in our life, which included having to close down and not give tours out at the lighthouse. So at the same time, the National Lighthouse Museum, which is on Staten Island, it's right next door to the ferry terminal for the Staten Island Ferry, and was at one time a Coast Guard base, and it was a Coast Guard buoy depot. And it was a place where I not only took one of my commands in for a mid-patrol break, but also after that, I was assigned to an organization which had its headquarters in that building, which is now the National Lighthouse Museum. And so it is a very important place in my life, and I'm delighted that the Lighthouse Museum has been established and founded in order to make an appropriate use of that grand old building. So I got a signal from them during the week, and the lighthouse was for the week, and they have one every week or sort of every other week, was Kilauea Light on the island of Kauai. Now, all of us Westpac hands, all of us people who have sailed in the Western Pacific, and in particular out of the Coast Guard base at Sand Island, which is right across from Aloha Tower in Honolulu Harbor, will have steamed out and headed to the west, and we've headed out along the island chain If you were in one of the steamships, you stopped in Midway for fuel. If you were in one of the longer-legged ships, you may not have had to stop in Midway. But the Kilauea on the island of Kauai is the northernmost light in the island chain on any of the inhabited islands. And so when you went out to Ocean Station Victor, where I started my seagoing career after I graduated the academy, where we would go out, we would occupy Ocean Station Victor, 34 North, 164 East, halfway between between Honolulu and Tokyo. And we occupied that station for 3 to 4 weeks, depending on weather and relief. Then we would go on into Japan. We would be in Japan for at Yokosuka Naval Base. And we would be there for maybe 10 days, then come back, occupy the station again, then head back to Honolulu. And heading back to Honolulu, the first light, the landfall light. Captains always look for that landfall light. And coming back into the Hawaiian island chain, the first light that you would see would be Kilauea light. And it has a very interesting story, as do almost all lighthouses. This one was built around 1908, and this was not very long after the end of the monarchy and the beginning of the territorial period. And shipping coming across the Pacific, Transpac, was increasing dramatically. And so the lighthouse service decided to build the light at Kilauea. And they thought that they were building it on solid ground. But as the construction proceeded, they found that the building was sinking, and it was sinking down, down, down. And so they went down and did some more core drilling, and they had to go down about 8 to 10 feet before they hit some solid lava that would be a suitable foundation, which means the Kilauea Light is one of the very few lighthouses that has a basement. Point Robinson Light has no basement. We have them in the quarters, but the light itself is sitting on solid rock, and it has no basement. So I took a look at the photograph of the light as it appears to be today, and then I read the description, and it said that when the light was built, a second-order Fresnel lens was installed. And it gave the builder, there were only a few builders of Fresnel lenses, and all of them were in France. And it said that it was a second-order light. But I looked up at the photograph, and that is sure one big and beautiful first order. And the reason why I believe that it's a first order, and maybe the caption is a little bit thwartships, is that the description went on to say that this lens was floated in a pool of mercury. And the reason why many of the heavier lenses were floated on a pool of mercury was that in order to rotate the lens, it was done through a clockwork mechanism, and the clockwork mechanism could not overcome the friction of most metal-on-metal bearings. And so a pool of mercury was in a trough, and this was the bearing. The lens was floated on top of this, which meant that some lighthouse keepers developed mercury poisoning. It was not known until somewhat later that people get sick from that. And so any place that you see today a lens which is floating on a pool of mercury, that pool has either been replaced with some other type of bearing or it has a cover over it. I don't know of any lenses that I can think of right now that are indeed floating in an active pool of mercury, even one with a cover. But that's why they were built that way. And our lens is a fifth order Fresnel, and it rotated on a bearing surface with wheels on the base of the lens itself. And it also was rotated by a clockwork mechanism. Fresnel lenses, of course, are absolutely beautiful pieces. All true Fresnel lenses were built in France, and they work on the principle of refracting or bending light rather than reflecting it. We could get a little bit into the physics of Fresnel lenses, maybe in some future broadcast. But I bring up Kilauea Light because it is the lighthouse of the week, and because those of us who have spent a lot of time steaming around Westpac and headed back to Hawaii, your landfall light was always Kilauea Light. The auction people have put a list or have put a listing in Professional Mariner, one of my favorite magazines. It is not the magazine for this week. That's going to be another issue of the week. But there is an auction coming up, and if Captain Joe's people would like to get together and form up an LLC where we buy a 125-foot survey boat that was built for the Army Corps of Engineers. Corps of Engineers, of course, is a very old part of the U.S. Army, and it has a certain amount of autonomy. And many people don't realize that the Corps operates almost all of the locks in places where we have locks in this country. They operate, for example, the locks at Sault Ste. Marie in Michigan. And those are all operated by the Army Corps of Engineers, and an organization that goes back to probably the 1830s, 1840s, and still called the Army Corps. It has its own badge. It looks like a castle. And so they had built back in the beginning of before World War II this 125-foot survey boat. It was to be used for doing surveys in areas where the predecessor organization to NOAA, called the Coast and Geodetic Survey, was not doing surveys, particularly in places like the Great Lakes. So she's coming up for sale. The bids will be open on the 23rd of June. And what I find a little bit deceptive is the description of her says that she is in line to be put on the National Register of Historic Places. And the listing goes on to say that should she be so listed, that she would qualify for all of these wonderful grants and free issues of money from the federal and the state government. So I'm here to say, since I am very much involved with my own Ingham, that who is also on the National Register of Historic Places, and I know that Bill Verge, who is the executive director of the Ingham Museum, would be delighted to have some of that money flowing down on him. It isn't quite so simple, and it's a little bit deceptive to list this particular little ship and list her in such a way that she'd be eligible for all of these money. So should Captain Joe's people put together an LLC to make all of these things happen and we buy this boat, then we're not automatically going to be in line for all kinds of money from it. The I now go to a more serious matter. And it is important for me to talk about this now because I've been following with a great deal of sadness the story and the saga of the USS George Washington, one of the Nimitz-class carriers that has been in the shipyard for now over a year. And just in the last few weeks, she's had three of her crew members take their own lives, commit suicide. And that has triggered a veritable Niagara of information coming from the Coast Guard, from my own service, to commanding officers and commanders about signals to be watching out for when shipmates are showing signs that they are in serious and deep distress. My concern about the George Washington is part of a much larger concern, which I've expressed on this program many times. And that is that our brother organization, our brother service, our sister service, if you like, the United States Navy, is showing signs of some serious stress and some serious troubles. I talked about this when we talked about the Fitzgerald collision. And we talked about the McCain collision, and we talked about the young sailors that were lost in both of those tragedies. And then we talked about Bonhomme Richard and the fire in Bonhomme Richard. And these are just examples. There are a number of others that we could talk about, and I have talked about in the past. I'm not saying that my own service is not without its own concerns. It is indeed. It is far too top-heavy with flag officers and senior executive service civilians, for example, Master Chief Coast Guard, Master Chiefs who are not out in the fleet raising young captains. I was indeed raised by two chief petty officers, and if I've been a good captain at all any time in my career, it was because I was raised by those two chiefs in my first command afloat myself when I was 23. And that's where those master chiefs ought to be. They should be out there raising those young junior officers, those young captains, and they should be raising those young sailors so that the service is being run the way that it should be by experienced and seasoned captains, by experienced and seasoned district commanders, by experienced and seasoned division and departmental heads in the ships, and in particular by experienced and seasoned senior enlisted people. The senior enlisted in all of the military should be the backbone around which the rest of the service swings. I feel this so strongly because I have been the beneficiary of having been raised as part of that background. And so when I see things like this USS George Washington with three sailors taking their own lives in a relatively short period of time, that tells me that there is something going on in that ship that somebody senior to her captain should have picked up on. One of the things that I would look at would be, for example, the unit punishment book. How many times is that captain held mast? How many of his sailors in a crew of, let's say, not counting the air group, which has its own air group commander, but let's say just ship's company is maybe 3,500 people. And out of 3,500 people, how many of the ship's company have been up before him at captain's mast, what in the other services is called Article 15, non-judicial punishment? How many court-martials have been convened in that ship? My guess is a higher number than what one would expect in a ship that is well-run, including a ship whose existence swings around, in particular, the senior enlisted people, the master chiefs, the senior chiefs, and the chief petty officers. So I am hopeful, and I'm tracking the USS George Washington really closely because finally somebody in her chain of command, above her captain, has picked up on this and has convened some sort of a board of inquiry to look into what is called, I believe, in the jargon of the United States Navy today, command culture. Well, I'm not so sure about the term command culture. I just know I can go aboard a ship, and I'll bet I could do it even with USS George Washington, and go down into the chief's mess and have a conversation in the goat locker. It's by the way, it's called the goat locker, and there's a reason for that, which is beyond the scope of our talk today. But I could go down into the goat locker and sit down with the chief of the boat, and within 15 minutes get a pretty good idea of the morale and why that ship is having the kind of troubles that she is. One of them, of course, is that she's been in a yard availability for a year, and that just tears a crew apart. You get a ship in, you get it out. And I know they're big ships. I know they're complicated. I know also that there have been a lot of problems with shipyards sticking to the schedules that have been built into the shipyard contract. So I am hopeful that there'll be a good and air clearing in this particular ship, and that gets extended to other places in our sister service. In the meantime, this morning I got I got two All Coast. The All Coast are messages that go out from the Commandant to all Coast Guard people. And both of them had to do with recognizing sailors who are in serious trouble and who may be contemplating taking their own life. There were a couple of things that came out of all of this, though, that sort of turned me off. And the first one, All Coast 173, started out really well. It talked about things to watch out for. It was easy to digest. I'm not saying that Coast Guard people can't handle some more convoluted language, but this one really got convoluted because the next thing in the second paragraph was, and now we want you to talk to work-life employee assistance program coordinators. Who the hell are they? And why do I have to have one of them in my ship? My chief of the boat, my XO, both of them ought to be advising me when there are problems down below. And, in fact, in all six of my commands afloat, plus my large command ashore, that's exactly what happened. XO, in my shore command, my deputy was his title, and my senior enlisted advisor ashore and my chief of the boat in all of my ships, all of them were in constant communication with me about the health of the command because I had to make decisions about that was based on the health of that command. I had to make decisions about mission accomplishment based on the health of that command. And so people have got to tell the captain how his command is doing. And he's got to go down, and when he does inspection, he talks to the people reporting compartments ready for inspection. He talks to them. He finds out whether they've got children being born and congratulates them when they've been advanced in rate. All of those things. These things are not hard, but they do require experience and they do require just giving a damn about what goes on with your people and not giving a damn about whether you're checking all the boxes to be promoted. And that's what I have to say about all of that. And boy, did I really get that one really came from up in the captain's chair. So here we go with to make things a little bit lighter. This is an excerpt from this week's The Week, which, as you all recall, comes from London. It is a Brit publication, and it is a summary of the press from all over the world. And so the article that I want to quote here is, it says, the headline is, Vegan Diets May Be Good for Dogs. Now, we have vegan friends here on the island, and having them for a meal is a real challenge because you want to do them honor by providing a meal that they will eat and enjoy. Mary R., when we first hosted some vegan friends, did a great deal of research and came up with a meal which was certainly acceptable to our vegan guests, but in terms of meat level was not all that acceptable to her captain. In any case, this article goes on to say that it may well be that, caption underneath is a picture of a Labrador. And this Labrador has a bunch of carrots. The carrots are dangling out of the port side of the mouth, and all of the greenery is dangling out of the starboard side of the dog's mouth. And underneath it says, is a vegan diet best for Fido? Well, I leave that to the vegans and to the veterinarians to figure all of those things out. But then the next one, article in that same column under Health and Science, page 19 of this week's Week, says, medieval kings were flexitarian. A defining image of the Anglo-Saxon era is a banquet table where kings and nobles eat from platters overflowing with meat. Well, I have to leave that one because it is, as always, my hope and wish that we end our time with all of us feeling a little bit better about ourselves and about the world in which we live. And by golly, I sure feel better about it now, because that article goes on to say that maybe they didn't eat all that much meat as we may have thought. And so meals consisting of things like pottages of leeks and whole grains with a little meat thrown in. And boy, does that make me feel a little bit better. And so now we come to the end of our time together. It is, as always, my wish and my hope and my command that each of you who are responsible for other people will indeed watch their six, take good care of them, take good care of yourselves. This is your Captain Joe, up in the captain's chair, always on station and watching properly. We never say goodbye. We say until we meet again.